From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Later today, we'll likely know whether supermarket employees will strike. Nearly 16 years ago, a months-long supermarket labor dispute took a heavy toll on both sides. For food shoppers, things changed dramatically with the rise of Costco, Trader Joe's, Target, and Walmart. We'll look at the potential changes another strike could bring right after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to be back with you after a couple of weeks vacation trip I've been wanting to make for many years to Spain. I had a wonderful time with our family and great to be back with you today. We have much to talk about. Coming up later this hour, our political analysts talk about much that's happened in the past week, including the two big Democratic candidates' debates of last week. First, want to thank Kyle Stokes, Libby Denkman, John Raby, all of whom filled in on Air Talk and Film Week while I was away. Want to thank them very, very much for the wonderful work that they did while I was on vacation. We begin today by looking both forward and back to relations between supermarket employees and the large companies that operate the big chains here in Southern California. That would be Albertsons, which has the supermarkets Vons and Pavilions and Albertsons here in Southern California, and Kroger, which owns the Ralph's stores throughout Southern California. Later today, we're expecting to hear from the unions whether the employees will go out on strike. This is a result of an impasse over a potential new three-year deal. But we're going to look back at what happened nearly 16 years ago when a protracted dispute involving both lockouts and striking employees forever changed the supermarket business of the Southland. With us, Los Angeles Times business writer James Pelz, who's been closely following the story. Jim, good to have you with us. Let's start, first of all, with the landscape that's so different this time around. 16 years ago, yes, there was Costco, but Trader Joe's wasn't as big. Target wasn't as deeply into groceries. Walmart hadn't established some of its smaller stores that are grocery only. It's a very different field today.
Well, you're absolutely right, Larry. I mean, in fact, 16 years ago, that was one of the main reasons that the supermarkets at the time took such a hard line on their labor and the cost of their labor, because they knew, they could see then that people like Walmart and Target and others were moving aggressively into the grocery business, and a lot of them are non-union, and profit margins in the grocery business already are very thin, often 1 or 2 cents per dollar of sales. That's why they were trying then to keep their labor costs down. And frankly, what we're seeing now is the same thing sort of all over again, because people like Walmart, Costco, as you mentioned, Trader Joe's, some of the other big chains, Whole Foods, now they're totally, major players in Southern California. So the pressure on the companies, on the supermarkets, is greater than ever.
And one of the things I recall about 16 years ago, I remember, going to my local Vons and one of the checkers who I'd known for years, and going to the market, stopped me and said, "Mr. Mantle, please don't shop here. Let me explain what this means to us." And I remember I was talking 20 minutes in the parking lot and, hearing what she had to say about it. And, once finally the strike was over, she and many of her coworkers were gone. There was a tremendous turnover. This happened at multiple stores as well under the terms of the new contract. And I wonder, Jim, if it's possible we could see similar kinds of turnover, particularly if this is a protracted strike.
It's possible, but let's step back for a minute. First of all, there's not going to be a strike, I don't think, in the near term, like within the next couple of weeks. I mean, they have another round of bargaining set for, I believe, the 10th in a few days. So I don't think we're that close yet. But your point is well taken. I mean, for people who weren't here 16 years ago, or maybe you're too young to remember, it's hard to overstate just how disruptive that whole event was. People will tell you who follow the grocery business that we all are creatures of habit and convenience when it comes to supermarkets. We tend to shop at the same places over and over again. We even tend to walk up and down the aisles in a store the same way. And so when that happened, you're exactly right. Suddenly, cashiers and other people that you've come to know and that you see all, at least once a week, suddenly were out in the parking lot striking. So a lot of consumers in Southern California first had to make a decision, do I cross the picket lines? And then if they did cross the picket lines, what happened was they would go into the stores, and for a good number of stores, the Teamsters who drive the trucks and deliver all the goods, they also were supporting the grocery workers, so the deliveries got interrupted and there were bottlenecks and things like that, and you often found aisles or shelves in the aisles that were half full. It was just a jarring sort of experience to suddenly walk into your local supermarket and see the shelves were not full like they normally are. And then for the people who did not want to cross the picket lines, suddenly they were going to have to decide to try other chains, and that's where they started trying a Gelson's, or they started trying Walmart, or they started trying Trader Joe's, and came to decide, well, this isn't that bad. I actually kind of like this place. And because this dragged on for so long, it was the longest supermarket strike in history, 4.5 months, then they became regular customers. And they estimate that something like 10% of all supermarket shoppers at the time were displaced permanently. They ended up going elsewhere.
We're talking with Jim Peltz, Los Angeles Times business writer, closely following the dispute between the union representing employees of the major supermarket chains and those chains themselves. Later today, we expect word on the potential of a strike. Already a strike authorization vote was taken and approved by the employees. I'd like to hear from you what your experience was of that four-month-long combination strike lockout of nearly 16 years ago. And if you were someone who was working for one of the supermarkets at the time, what was that experience like for you? Perhaps being out on the picket line in the parking lot, talking with customers who you'd gotten to know over the years. And maybe you didn't come back after the strike, or maybe you experienced it then. You're still working for one of these supermarkets. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We covered that story so intensely on Air Talk, it seemed like Rick Icaza, who was the head of the United Food and Commercial Workers Local, was on the show almost every day. It was as he was talking about what the stakes were for their employees. And of course, on the supermarket side, they typically were putting out daily statements about their perspective. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org, and share with us your thoughts, your memories of that strike, and what a significant impact it had on the food shopping experience here in Southern California. Jim, what are some of the specifics of the dispute here? Is it largely over hourly wages? Is it about health benefits? What's going on?
Well, the union says it's primarily wages. And they claim, and the supermarkets haven't refuted this, they haven't said much about the specific terms that have been going back and forth. The union claims that the stores are offering their workers a pay increase of less than 1% a year for the next 3 years. It would be a three-year contract. And that is their main complaint, is that the wage increases wouldn't be high enough. There also are issues to do with health care and pensions, but that seems to be the primary one. And one of the things that's come into play here, specifically in Los Angeles and some other communities, is the minimum wage, which is kind of an interesting dynamic that's thrown into all of this. And that is, if you look, the workers right now are working under the three-year contract that they had, expired in March, but they're still working under it. And if you look at the wage scales in there, I mean, it all depends, of course, on how long you've worked at the store. But a good number of these people would have been earning less than the minimum wage now if that hadn't gone into effect. In fact, I think here in Los Angeles, the minimum wage went up to $14.25, I believe it is, today, on its way to $15 in the next year or two. And a good number of those workers would not be earning $14.25 under the old contract if this change hadn't taken place. So the unions, you know, maintains that the stores are not doing enough to keep their workers well above the minimum wage, which is what they desire.
Jim, thank you. Always appreciate your willingness to come on and talk about this. And I have the feeling we'll be talking with you again soon as we get more update on the negotiations. Thanks so much.
Pleasure, Larry. Thank you.
Thanks. Jim Peltz, Los Angeles Times business writer. He also covered the 2003-2004 strike, as we did on Air Talk, as a chance to provide a little historic perspective. And obviously, it is a very different business today. And, you know, 16 years ago, often people would go to their neighborhood supermarket, and that would be it. Now, not uncommon for people to go 2, 3, 4 different places to get different items, maybe buying in bulk at Costco, maybe going to Whole Foods for a specialty item, picking up stuff at Target when shopping for sundries, and also getting food while you happen to be at Target. People shop very differently now, and we're talking about how the experience changed with the 4-month-long labor dispute between workers of the supermarkets and the chains 16 years ago. 866-893-KPECC. Let's talk with Mary in Culver City. Mary, take us back. How did it change your shopping experience?
Well, I've lived in the same house for 19 years. I shopped at Albertsons, and it's my most convenient place. It's on my way home. It was near my house. And 16 years ago, I was supporting the strikers, and it was really brutal. It was hard, harder for them than me, but it was difficult to have to kind of find another place to go. I'm not a really big fan of any other store, frankly. And so I muddled through that and tried not to cross that picket line. And I did. I went to, Trader Joe's. I found a different Ralph's that was farther away, kind of near where I work. And the same is true now. I'm a pretty loyal customer. I go to Vons now, and it's convenient. It's by my kids' school in my home, and if they strike, I will respect it, but it will be hard. It is a little easier, though, because I do shop at Target a little bit now.
Yeah, Mary, there are a lot more options now. Appreciate your call very much. Let's talk with Ann in the Mid-Wilshire District. You're on Air Talk.
Hi. Yeah, no, during the last strike that we had, I was a regular Ralph's shopper, Vaughn's shopper, Albertson, and I found that I had to go to places, and I discovered Trader Joe's, Whole Foods, ended up staying at those grocery stores because I found the experience to be just so much nicer, smaller. It felt like a more of a small town feel, and you know, we've had all those stuff that you could get anywhere else, but it just seemed to be a nicer shopping experience, and I have to say, I haven't gone back. Loyal Trader Joe's person, and enjoy going to Sprouts now and Whole Foods, and there's just so many other choices available, and the Korean markets that are in Koreatown where you can get some really great foods that you can't really find anywhere else.
That's a great point. Farmers markets have also become a bigger deal in the past decade and a half. So many different specialty places to get different types of groceries. And I appreciate your call. Thank you so much. You know, for me, one of the hardest things afterwards was the market that I went to where I knew a lot of the employees. They'd been there for years. These were real supermarket professionals. They were, you know, raising their kids on the salaries. They had good health care benefits. And as those folks were turning over, being replaced by other employees, it was sort of the loss of those familiar faces and people that I enjoyed checking in with as I shopped. Let me bring into the conversation from the publication supermarketguru.com, consumer behavior analyst Phil Lempert. Phil, good to have you with us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry. It's always a pleasure.
You were here in Southern California when this major dispute took place back nearly 16 years ago. What's some of the biggest memories or images that stuck with you after that?
Well, the memories, much like the two callers had, was that consumers started out really trying to respect it. But then what happened is a lot of the employees left. They had to support their families. They went to either other stores or left the supermarket business entirely. But also, they never went back. And that's been one of the problems. And you and Jim were talking about how the whole business of grocery has changed since that point in time. Today, the average shopper buys groceries in 9 different locations every month. So that could be a drug chain, it could be a farmer's market, as you just said. And the other factor that we didn't have 16 years ago is millennials and Generation Z. These two generations are very food involved, but they're very brand disloyal. So they're not going to look at the name on the outside of the supermarket. Their favorite store is Aldi, where they can get high quality, where it's a less expensive price. So the rules have really changed. So for this strike to take place in today's environment, in my opinion, is doomsday for everybody, for the retailer who are not going to be able to afford these price hikes, both from agriculture, because we're seeing more margins there increasing, as well as paying their employees more. So this is just fit for disaster.
JSK writes on the page, I've read Southern California has the most competitive food shopping market in the country. Aldi, that Phil just referenced, and 99-cent stores offer big savings that didn't exist very long ago. Michael from Southern from Orange County says, I prefer Stater Brothers. Why doesn't it get mentioned some of the farmers market-like stores like Sprouts, low-cost places like Grocery Outlet as well? Let's see, Astrogoth writes on the page, Ralph's hired a whole new crew for the strike. None of them had a clue what to do, and that was fun to watch. Again, you can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Crystal in Long Beach says, I work for a direct competitor in the online industry. I was a customer of these stores, but I switched to completely online shopping. And I think the union needs to be cautious because there are such razor-thin margins for these supermarkets and competition. Phil, that kind of echoes what you're saying here, is that, you know, this is going to be a huge challenge for the union.
It is. And just to build on the comment about Grocery Outlet, one of the things that we saw last strike is we saw a lot of the people who worked in supermarkets who had years of experience go and become a Grocery Outlet owner. And keep in mind, Grocery Outlet just went through this huge IPO just a couple weeks ago. They want to expand. This is going to be a boon for Grocery Outlet because they're going to be able to get a lot of great talent that wants to have their own store and not have to go through strike after strike after strike.
Phil, good to talk with you again. Thanks so much. And we'll keep you on speed dial as we see what happens in the next few days and weeks. We appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you. Phil Lempert of SupermarketGuru.com, consumer behavior analyst and supermarket expert. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, our weekly political roundup. Our analysts are just waiting to get to it. We have a lot to talk about as we recap the past week. Back in just 1 minute.
Yeah, I just want to say that this is my honor. I didn't really expect it. We were in Japan for the G20. We came over, and I said, hey, I'm over here. I want to call up Chairman Kim. And we got to meet, and stepping across that line was a great honor. A lot of progress has been made.
President Trump yesterday becoming the first American president to set foot in North Korea as he met with that country's leader, Kim Jong-un, at the demilitarized zone, and then did that photo op in North Korea. We begin our political roundup with the president's meeting and those few words that were exchanged as a part of that photo op. Jack Pitney with us from Claremont McKenna College, where he's professor of politics, and Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist, former senior Obama advisor in 2008. Gentlemen, good to have you with us. Matt, let me start with you and the North Korea photo op, the third meeting between President Trump and the North Korean leader.
seems like it's all set. You got taken care of. You know, it's so difficult to know exactly what's happening with this administration on this issue because I think Trump knew by walking over the line that was going to be the big news. It's not clear to what end that is going to be. It just because at the end of the day, they're either going to have more nukes or they're not. And, you know, what I think is concerning, and this is obviously a lot of what's happening and a lot of talking heads are saying on TV as well, which is it's just Kim Jong-un seems to be getting a lot of stuff for nothing right now. Like you're getting, you know, a president walking into North Korea is obviously huge news. It's a very big deal in Pyongyang now. It's not clear what the actual strategy is here to actually reduce or keep nuclear weapons out of that country or reduce it to as small a number as possible. So Trump is kind of opaque in these things. I think at one level it'll be a political win because he's dominating the news coverage and that is important. I'm just not quite clear substantively exactly what he's achieving or what the kind of plan is moving forward.
Well, and I'm not unclear on what the PR benefit to the president is. Obviously for Kim Jong-un, this is a huge win for him to have a U.S. president step into his country. But, Jack, do you see a benefit to the U.S. president for this?
Well, Trump apparently believes that any kind of negotiation works to his advantage from a visual standpoint, though the visuals were not entirely flattering to Trump in a very direct way. He was the cameras showed him from behind, which is not the best angle for Donald Trump. The story coming out today in the New York Times is that the Trump administration is considering an offer of a nuclear freeze, that is, getting an agreement from North Korea not to build any additional nuclear weapons, but they can keep what they have. And I'm old enough to remember the 1980s and the proposed nuclear freeze between the U.S. and the Soviet Union and how adamantly Ronald Reagan opposed that. In fact, that was the occasion for probably his most famous speech, the Evil Empire speech. Obviously, it's a different situation, but the idea was that if you lock an adversary into a position that you don't want, that's not really the best outcome.
Well, and what's also interesting, if you look at the Soviet Union back then, at the end of the day, the United States was able, just because of its own economic system, sort of grow and sort of overwhelm the Soviet system, which collapsed under its own sort of inefficiencies and inability to be a viable economic system. That's not totally the case with North Korea. They're already a disaster. They're looking to grow. So oddly enough, like in the United States' case, they're kind of able to sort of like strangle, put almost like a boa constrictor hold on the Soviet Union. But kind of the opposite potentially is happening here, which is they're going to get to keep their nuclear weapons. And I assume they're going to try to continue to have some kind of more of an open market or something, which will help North Korea and will only solidify Kim Jong-un. So I'm just not clear substantively what he's trying to accomplish here.
Well, I'm far from a nuclear expert, but I'm just wondering if there's just a quantitative difference that makes this significant, because obviously the nuclear freeze proposed with the Soviets, they had a huge stockpile at the time. North Korea, we don't know, but it's certainly we're not talking USSR quantities here. Is this potentially far more advantageous to the U.S. to have a freeze with North Korea than it would have been with the Soviets?
The difference is Kim Jong-un is not as rational as the Soviet leaders were in the 1980s. These were bad guys, but they were also intelligent and calculating leaders, whereas Kim Jong-un is somewhat different.
Mercurial.
Having even 50 or 60 nukes in the hands of somebody like that is a dangerous situation, which is exactly why for so long American policy has been trying to get them to zero. And if we don't accomplish that, we have a problem.
Well, and it's almost a capitulation to say North Korea is now going to be a major player in that part of the world. And it's slightly concerning because, as Jack mentioned, we really they don't have the economic or diplomatic or, frankly, human rights record to be in that position. But if they have nuclear weapons and you're essentially allowing that is you're essentially backdooring them into that position. And that, I think, is also concerning when you still got China, which is its own separate issue in that part of the world. So
well, let's talk about China since you just brought it up, Matt, and the ongoing trade negotiation, stock market with a strong response to the fact that they're going to keep talking about this. So, Jack, do you see any sort of a light at the end of the tunnel to this?
At the end of the tunnel, this may be a circular tunnel. We may end up in a situation not terribly different from what we started with.
Cul-de-sac.
The Huawei concession that Trump made pleased the markets today. I'm not sure the national security experts are crazy about that. So it's very difficult to see how we end up in a more advantageous position at the end than we did at the beginning, but it provides visuals for Trump.
Yeah, I think the Huawei thing's really concerning, actually, because that is a much larger issue in terms of security, privacy, and what the Chinese are attempting to do in terms of infiltrating, whether it's Europe and eventually the United States, through people's devices. And this is a very complicated, large, you know, I don't claim to have any kind of expertise, but it seems like he had taken a position on Huawei. Now it just sort of have given that away as quickly as he did. That, I think, is concerning. And like the same thing I've argued with North Korea, it's just not clear exactly what his end game is. China is a problem. And I actually had some, respect is the word, but I understood Trump going after them a little bit. It's not just about their economic bullying that they've done. There's a lot of concerns around their intellectual property and national security. But then you get to hear now it's sort of like, what was the point of all of this?
Yeah.
Now?
So what changed about Huawei that made it less of a threat to national security?
I can't think of one thing. And it appeared, at least Huawei had talked about it in the last couple of weeks, that they were really being hurt by some of the restrictions on them. They had taken some big hits. So I'm not quite sure about it. And whatever sort of short-term stock market being up a couple hundred points or a political gain he thinks he gets, someone's going to have to reckon with what China is doing here, whether it's the next president or whether it's us as a country. But this is not a benign move by this country. And so it's concerning, and I'm not really sure what Huawei or what these types of if Huawei is your sort of like bargaining chip, I think that's a problem if that's where Trump is working in these negotiations.
Huawei, by the way, the huge electronics company, China-based company. We're talking with Matt Rodriguez joining us on Air Talk, Democratic political strategist Jack Pitney of Claremont McKenna College as well. Did want to talk about Iran, where they came out with a statement that they're going to be essentially violating the terms of the nuclear agreement that the U.S., of course, pulled out of, but that the EU continues with. So, Jack, just things seem to be continuing to degrade with Iran.
Yeah, this is not a good situation. The United States is not in as strong a position as it might have been. It's very hard to criticize a country for violating an agreement that we pulled out of in the first place. So I think that hasn't worked out well for Trump. This is an extremely volatile situation. In fact, right now I'm watching a documentary about World War I. And how various miscalculations led to disaster. And this is a part of the world where that could very easily take place. And we've already found out a couple of times that wars in that part of the world are not necessarily quick or easy to win. So I think we need to approach this with great care.
Yeah, unpredictable. What's interesting here is we're going to talk, I'm sure, about the debates, obviously, a lot, and there's a lot of domestic stuff going on, but it does go to show how quickly the narratives can change, whether it's from presidential point of view or just national politics, because there's a lot going on around the world, and it's all of a sudden happened very quickly. Iran has been percolating the last couple of weeks. We had North Korea. You've got Asia. What's happening? So these things tend to move quickly. Same thing on Iran. I agree with Jack. When you sort of pull out of the deal, it's difficult to. I assume it's sort of negotiating tactic by the Iranians. This is a very volatile regime as well, and it's not clear what his plan is to kind of move them back to the negotiating table, what he actually wants out of them. And so to me, it's somewhat similar to North Korea, just on the opposite side. For some reason, we had a deal with Iran. He's insisted on blowing that up without seeming to have a particular plan in place to get them to where he wants to be. And North Korea seems to be on the other side, which is he's not demanding a whole lot of them, yet giving the leader of that country a lot. So, again, if you can figure out Trump, I can't. But there's a lot going on foreign policy-wise, which could shape a lot of our politics here over the next year.
All right. We're going to take a brief break and come back. We're going to look at the big U.S. Supreme Court decisions, talk about the gerrymandering setting of district boundaries along partisan advantage, what the court said about that last week, also taking up President Trump's DACA plan and much more to come. And we revisit last Wednesday and Thursday's Democratic presidential candidates debates. We'll play some clips as well. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, back after a live update from Julie Slater. Wonderful to have you with us today on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to be back after a couple weeks on vacation. With me, Jack Pitney, professor at Claremont McKenna College, Matt Rodriguez, Democratic political strategist. We're talking about the major stories. Do you want to talk about the U.S. Supreme Court as their term ended and we got the partisan gerrymandering decision, essentially the majority view that this is not the role of the federal courts to be telling state legislators when they've crossed the line overdrawing their districts. Also, the citizenship question, saying that the Trump White House had not made its case successfully about adding the question of citizenship for the U.S. Census, and the fate of DACA will be taken up in the fall by the High Court. Matt, let me start with you. First of all, the gerrymandering decision.
Yeah.
We've been hearing for the past several days, Democrats think this was just a terrible decision. What do you see as its impact?
Well, I think it's huge in that, well, it basically shuts the door on judicial review around redistricting. So what you're going to have is states figuring out how they're going to approach the process. So I think that is a very big deal. It's a very big deal for a lot of Democrats because I think they feel like they look at a map and they say there's just large swaths of the country that we can't compete in. It's a place like North Carolina, for example. If you look at it, it's basically a 50-50 state or just slightly maybe leans a little bit Republican, and they've got something like 10 Republicans and 3 Democrats. And I think Democrats see that as with a more diverse coalition and a coalition that doesn't always vote as much as it should, especially in off-year elections. I think they see themselves as particularly disadvantaged by the gerrymandering that goes on around the country. And they feel like Republicans have gotten a huge advantage. So and then you have obviously Roberts' rationale was just like, there's no actual justifiable or defensible standard that you can make that a judge can say, here is how it should have gone. This is by definition a political process.
And how would you objectively ground it if the court's going to decide?
And why would a judge, when you've already got a political process to decide, one, how to do it, and if that's problematic, the voters should step in and say, well, we're unhappy with how our elected officials dealt with this. And so those are kind of the two lines on this one. Democrats are particularly upset because I think they saw working on gerrymandering as a key to have more access to winning seats over the course of the next however many decades. That's not going to happen.
Well, it's funny because here in California, Jack, as you well recall, it was Republicans who felt like Democrats really stacked the deck with partisan gerrymandering here.
Oh, yeah. In fact, in 1990, I actually was the guy who wrote the National Republican Party pamphlet on redistricting. Mm-hmm. And I was laying out the arguments that Democrats have been making about wasted votes and, you know, gerrymandering is horrible for democracy and all the rest. Yeah. Even if the decision had gone the other way, Democrats would still have a problem because of the distribution of the vote. The Democratic vote tends to be more heavily concentrated. I mean, you could fire a cannon down Wilshire Boulevard and not hit a Republican.
Yeah.
Whereas a Republican vote is more efficiently distributed. So again, even if the court had gone the other way, Democrats would still have a bit of a problem in House elections. Though they managed to overcome it in 2018 and win a majority.
Yeah. Well, it's just overwhelming. They're overwhelmingly in the urban areas, and so at some point, there's only so many ways to cut a district, and so. So we'll see, but it's a shot to Democrats who, you know, Obama had come out. There had been a lot of this trying to figure out how to, you know, have a better court decisions and better drawing of the maps. It doesn't mean that they're completely lost on this. And if they have another good election in 2020, then obviously the more state legislatures you have and governors, the better off you're going to do. So I just think that raises the political stakes for the election in 2020. Even more than it is right now.
Well, let's revisit the two Democratic candidates debates of last Wednesday and Thursday night. The prime star of the Wednesday night presentation was Elizabeth Warren, the Massachusetts senator, as she made her points about the economy and what she saw despite the so-called boom, how it really played out.
I think of it this way. Who is this economy really working for? It's doing great for a thinner and thinner slice at the top. It's doing great for giant drug companies. It's just not doing great for people who are trying to get a prescription filled. It's doing great for people who want to invest in private prisons, just not for the African Americans and Latinx whose families are torn apart, whose lives are destroyed, and whose communities are ruined.
Jack, do you think that her argument that it really isn't a booming economy for the majority of Americans, is that going to long term resonate with voters?
I think it very much could. There's a Associated Press poll out just in the past day that even though voters think the overall economy is strong, they really disapprove of President Trump's economic policy. Only 17% of voters say they got a tax cut. Now, actually,
which is not an accurate reflection of what really happened.
They weren't feeling it. That's the key thing in politics. Yeah. It's the perception. So a lot of people think they're falling behind. A lot of people think their fellow Americans are falling behind. So I think there's an audience for that, particularly next year, if there is in fact an economic downturn, and that could be a very powerful element of the setting that would help Democrats.
Matt, she had a huge advantage because she was the big name on Wednesday night. The other names were in the Thursday debate. So Cory Booker had a chance to shine Wednesday night.
But for Castro her,
but for her, this was a real gift.
Well, I've talked about this on the show a bunch, and I'm like a broken record, but I think one of the things you're starting to see is whenever you run for president, and it can vary depending on when you run because timing is everything. I think of Dick Gephardt, the guy I used to work for. When he ran in 88, you know, that was just the beginning of the Japanese and some of the cars coming in. And he was sort of a protectionist side of this. And if he'd run in 92, once the economy tanked, he probably would have been in a very good spot. But he didn't run because George H.W. Bush at the time was doing very well off of the Gulf War. No one thought, how could he possibly lose? He was at 89% of the polls. Long story short is a lot of those populist rantings that he had been doing in 88 would have been perfect when the economy tanked. He just didn't run and Bill Clinton won and the rest is history. My point on the head is you need to have something to say, and some of it's dictated on when you run. And there's only a few candidates, to be honest, in this race, despite having 80,000. It was like the cast of Ben-Hur up there. But at the end of the day, there's only a few who really have something to say. And Warren is benefiting from that because she has a specific philosophy, ideology, and it's economic-based. So while some of the other candidates are fighting on some of the cultural issues, she's hewing very closely to what she sees as a populist appeal from the left as opposed to the populist appeal by Trump on the right. And a lot of Trump's appeal is also just sort of rhetorical and his narrative. So she's doing well because she knows her stuff. She knows it better than the other candidates, and she's very prepared, and she knows exactly what she wants to say. Now, there's a negative with that, which is she's very far left, and I think this is going to come back to potentially hurt her in a general election. But unlike a lot of the other candidates, she knows exactly what she would do, and you're not going to trip her up on policy because she's an expert at it.
And her identity is so clear, and that's the challenge these candidates are trying to differentiate them so that a voter can say, okay, this is who this person is. Yeah. And with Elizabeth Warren, it's very clear what she's about.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I know this is a matter of cosmetics, but people dismiss her. Well, she's a Massachusetts liberal. But if you watch her, she sounds like she's from Oklahoma, which, in fact, she is.
Yeah.
And she does not come from an upper class background, comes from a really modest background. And that shows up in her rhetoric. So I think potentially put that together with her brains and her rhetorical ability, I think she's got a real shot.
She's formidable. And I want to say one other thing about Warren, because I had dismissed her earlier on. I didn't think she would be doing as well as she is. She's not only doing well on the policy, which is she's completely driving the policy. She's completely like, you know, you can see Bernie must be being driven crazy watching her kind of continue to come from. But she's also setting a lot of the politics. She was the first to come out for impeachment. Like, she's very smart about being hardcore on some of the stuff on immigration quickly as a shot to the base and then getting back to what her economic argument is. And in some ways, she's proven to be much more nimble, I think, than Sanders is, who just said to me, at least if you watched him on the second, I just sounded like a broken record. It's like, well, we heard this all in 2016, and it's very hard to just say the same stuff. She's doing a very nice job of setting both the politics right now and the policy. That's a hard thing to do. And she's doing that pretty well, I think, so far.
She has that feeling like in sports of a player who's gotten hot and just
That's
kind of the feeling, you know?
Yeah. She's like the baseball player who is hitting .435 in the last 10 games.
She's in that groove right now. Yeah. Well, one of the defining moments of Thursday night's debate, Senator Kamala Harris brought up recent comments that Joe Biden made about his willingness to work with segregationists and Biden's opposition to the policy of court-ordered busing.
I do not believe you are a racist, and I agree with you when you commit yourself to the importance of finding common ground. But I also believe, and it's personal and it was hurtful, to hear you talk about the reputations of two United States senators who built their reputations and career on the segregation of race in this country. you also worked with them to oppose busing. And, you know, there was a little girl in California who was part of the second class to integrate her public schools. And she was bused to school every day. And that little girl was me.
And Biden responded?
I did not oppose busing in America. What I opposed is busing ordered by the Department of Education. That's what I opposed.
Well,
I
there
did
was
not
a failure of states to integrate public schools in America. I was part of the second class to integrate Berkeley, California public schools almost two decades after Brown v. Board of Education.
Because your city council made that decision. It was a local decision.
So that's where the federal government must step in. That's why we have the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act.
All right. When we come back, we'll hear what our political analysts have to say about that exchange. I, too, was part of the second class of court-ordered integration in the city of Inglewood when I was in junior high school. And later this week, we're actually going to open up the phones and talk with others of you who were part of that experience to give a little more depth to what happened during that period when districts like LA Unified, Inglewood, Pasadena, other districts were ordered by federal courts to desegregate through busing. We'll be back with more in 1 minute on Air Talk. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. With me, Matt Rodriguez, Democratic political strategist, and Jack Pitney, Claremont McKenna College professor as well. We just heard those back-to-back clips from Thursday night's Democratic candidates debate on NBC. Jack, let me start with you on this. Kamala Harris went after Joe Biden when he had been touting his ability to even go so far as to work with segregationists while serving in public office. What did you think of how each of them came off in that exchange?
Obviously, she got a lot of support and applause. Biden was unprepared. And this is baffling because it's exactly the kind of issue his team should have been able to anticipate. Every campaign does a vulnerability study. You go basically opposition research on yourself, and this is top of the list. And so that doesn't speak well for his campaign. Though, politically, this is not a great issue for Democrats. Number one, it's not really a live issue. Supreme Court ruled against busing over a decade ago. And to the extent there's polling on it, it's not something Americans are crazy about. It's a very, very complicated issue and does not necessarily work to the Democrats' favor to
and
have this front and center.
And was historically divisive among Democrats at the time. So, Matt, your thoughts on
it? Yeah, I thought, look, you do what you need to do to kind of get in the moment. And so I guess from a raw political point of view, it worked for Harris, right? She raised a bunch of money. She's moved up 6 points, which in the morning consult poll in Politico, which came exactly out of Biden. He's down six. She's up six. So all of that's good. There's a few potential issues. I was saying last week, I don't want to be a wet blanket, but there's a few issues around both this issue, but I think Kamala in general. Now, she may keep taking off and keep growing, and that could happen. We don't know what's going to happen. I just think there's a lot of that particular issue is, I don't think, is going to win or lose this election. So she has staked a lot of this on this particular issue right now. Jack is right. Biden was not prepared. I have no idea why he wasn't prepared. Some of this is the peril of his candidacy because he's trying to both look back to the Obama years and then try to look forward because he doesn't want to go too far back because the bottom line is he was a senator in the 1970s. And some of those guys, the segregationists, they act as if they were – that's in the 1970s. Those guys, they've been there for 20 or 30 years. That gets back to the 40s and the 50s. So it wasn't uncommon to have to work with those folks. So I get Kamala got a short-term bump out of that, but we're going to have to see what African-American voters really think about this. Obama, his guy is Joe Biden. Doesn't mean Obama's going to support him, but Biden worked there. We're going to have to see if African-American voters are going to take this out on Biden from a polling perspective, because if they don't, she's really put herself way out there and attacked the vice president pretty mercilessly, and there's a lot of anger in the vice president's camp around this, and this stuff tends to come around. The second thing I would say is she needs to get a better handle on policy. Mm-hmm. She stepped into the healthcare thing again, and at the end of the day, her impassioned speeches and her prosecutorial stuff is good, and that's great, but that is only one-tenth of what's going to get her there. And she continues to say she's for single payer and then tries to walk it back. She doesn't seem to understand what single payer is, to be perfectly honest. And I know we're kind of caught up in the moment right now, and she's doing great, and that is great. And that matters in a presidential campaign. But some of her stuff around immigration and around healthcare are going to be problematic. And it's not clear she totally understands those issues well enough to stop getting into the trap of whether it's single payer, whether it's taking people's health care away. She kind of tries to have it both ways. And at some point, the more she rises in the polls and money, people are going to start zoning
in on
that.
This gets back again to the Elizabeth Warren advantage because she knows this stuff backwards and forwards.
She does, and at least so far Harris doesn't. And she's done this now twice on the health care one. And that is a very, as we know in American politics, a very touchy subject.
Yeah, she immediately flip-flopped on whether she's going to allow private health insurance.
Yeah.
And, the health care is an issue that the Democrats own, and it takes a certain kind of massive mistake to lose that issue, but that's what she's in danger of doing. So if I were advising her campaign, I'd tell her to get her story straight and stick to it.
Well, and what she just – I don't understand why they just don't say we're going to extend Obamacare coverage and buy into Medicare. And if we got, and they can still say they're for single payer in concept. For some reason, they're going down this road, and the Republicans are going to make them pay a big price in about a year on that issue if they're not more careful.
I wanted to ask you both, this switching entirely, but Twitter came out last week and said it's going to label certain politicians who have large followings if their tweets run afoul of Twitter's standards for personal attacks, things like that, and put a label on it. This has been widely interpreted to mean that some of President Trump's tweets are going to be labeled. Jack, what do you think about Twitter doing? Because I don't quite see what the upside is. They're going to be damned one way or the other, whether they label or not.
Yeah, and the example that's been cited is the very bizarre tweet that Trump had during the Fire and Fury stage in which he told Kim Jong-un, "I've got a big button." Freudians can read all what they want into that. But I don't think anybody needed a Twitter advisory to follow what was going on there. So, again, I don't know what the value added here is.
I think actually that could be good for Trump. I mean, I think he would absolutely die to get have one tweet banned or labeled. I mean, he would go absolutely bananas.
That'd be the seal of approval.
That is sort of a good housekeeping seal. But it also really would politically allow him to say, look, once again, here's the tech elites. Everybody's coming after me. And one of the things Trump did at his announcement, which I thought was weird, but he occasionally hits on some good political themes. And one of them was he talked about himself the entire time and him. But then he does sit there and say the attacks on me are an attack on you. They're an attack on us. And that is a powerful message for his. It was a big turnout driver in 2016. The economy's pretty good. And I do think that these types of sort of what will feel arbitrary, well, why are you banning him versus, and then the other side's going to, Fox News will come out and say, well, here, what about these 20 tweets from all these other lunatics? And so this, I do think, kind of plays into his hand. It's us against the world.
This, to me, touches on the cultural issues, which I thought were in play 3 years ago, and I thought kind of got short shrift in media coverage and analysis. So much was laid at the foot of the economics of those left behind and Trump, tapping into that. I really think that the cultural stuff, this friction between more rural, more suburban America and cities that are held by Democrats, I think this is a huge issue, Jack, and this kind of taps into that issue.
Yeah, and we were talking just a moment ago about Elizabeth Warren, and it's fascinating. She's starting to talk about her faith. Unlike the president, she can actually quote verses from the Bible.
Yeah. So is Pete Buttigieg. Yeah. The same thing.
Yeah, he talks about his faith a lot.
Fairly frequently.
Yeah, absolutely. Gentlemen, always a pleasure. Thank you so much. Good to have you with us. Jack Pitney, professor of politics, Claremont McKenna College. Matt Rodriguez, Democratic presidential, campaign strategist, was on the Obama presidential advisory team as well. Much more to come in the second hour. I'll tell you about it momentarily. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to be with you today. Hope your day's off to a strong start. Coming up later this hour, NBA free agency. This is one of the wildest off seasons in NBA history, with big stars like Kevin Durant switching teams, still Kawhi Leonard, the star in Toronto, the championship team. Question is, might he make his way to Southern California and leave Canada? We'll talk about that coming up a little bit later this hour. Also, the history and future of the automobile industry Are We There Yet? Dan Albert's wonderful new book that takes a look at the evolution of the American car. That comes up later this hour. But we begin, speaking of cars, with the implementation of the nearly 6 cents a gallon California gas tax increase, which goes into effect today. We already have among the highest prices for gasoline in the United States. This makes it go even higher today. The question is, where are these dollars going to go? And what degree of accountability will there be? As we know, in the past, California has implemented a number of taxes that were said to go for certain long-term areas of need. Those funds not necessarily making their way to actually pay for those improvements. With us to talk about the gas tax, Executive Director of the California State Association of Counties, Graham Knaus. Thank you, Graham, for joining us. We appreciate it very much. Where do you see these funds going, and to what degree is there going to be oversight of how these funds are spent?
Larry, good morning. Happy to join you today. Well, the first thing that we need to keep in mind is that we, as a state, dug ourselves into a serious hole over many, many decades by not sufficiently investing in our transportation infrastructure, including roads, bridges, and highways. These revenues are critically needed to ensure that our roads are safe, our bridges are safe. And our starting point for this is one with a number of communities suffering from dilapidated roads that are in desperate need of repair. And we can do so with these critical SB1-related revenues. There are 6,500 projects on roads and bridges all across the state that are moving forward as a result of these SB1 revenues.
If these revenues come in quickly and these projects are able to get started, you know, large numbers of them, is there the ability to manage all those projects simultaneously? Are there enough workers available in this tight job market to do that sort of road improvement work? Are there going to be potential hangups in actually getting these projects started and completed?
Well, we are 17 months into these revenues, and so there are a number of projects that have actually already been completed. Every community has prioritized the projects that need to be moved forward on first, and so we're doing exactly that in terms of identifying the bridges at most risk, those roads that need to be replaced and maintained at a higher level. That is all happening as well, it should. Certainly, by moving forward on a prioritized manner, it allows the greatest return on the taxpayer investment in terms of protecting communities and ensuring that we have a sufficient transportation infrastructure system in this state, which is what all 40 million Californians should expect and demand in their state.
We're talking with Graham Knaus, who's the executive director of the California State Association of Counties, talking about how the money raised from the nearly 6 cents a gallon increase in the gasoline tax for road projects. Also with us, consumer watchdog president of the Santa Monica-based nonprofit, Jamie Court. Jamie, good to have you with us again.
Good to be back.
So, Jamie, do you have concerns about how this money's going to be accounted for?
Well, actually, I have concerns that we're, paying so much at the pump right now. I mean, our price per gallon is $1.18 more than the rest of America. This tax is, if you look at it compared to the average tax, which is like 27 cents across America. So, it's another quarter, okay? The question for me and for, I think, what the state should be is, why do consumers keep getting charged this tax when we know that every summer the oil refiners, continue to make more and more on every gallon of gasoline? There's huge profits for the oil companies. So we know there's maybe 28 cents is what the oil industry estimates for environmental formulation more than the rest of the country. We know there's now maybe, 20, let's say a quarter more for the taxes for the roads. Where is, the other 70 cents per gallon going? And my proposal when Governor Brown had proposed, increasing the tax and the legislature agreed, was to go after the oil refiners' excess profits. In good times, they make about 50 cents a gallon. In times when we see, you know, a buck 18 more per gallon, they're getting close to double those profits. This should come out of the excessive profits of the oil industry. It should not come out directly out of the consumer's pockets. We need the roads. We have freeways. We don't have highways. Someone's got to pay for them. But consumers are paying too much, is our position.
We're talking with Jamie Cord of Consumer Watchdog, with Graham Knaus, California State Association of Counties, with us. If you have questions about the gasoline tax increase that goes into effect today, you might have noticed a bit of the shock at the pump if you went to fill up or drove by a gas station and saw the price sign with nearly 6 cents a gallon tax increase. We're 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Pippi writes on the page, Mr. Knaus, can you explain why those in charge have squandered all the funds from previous taxes supposedly earmarked for road maintenance? And where exactly are those tax dollars being spent?
I think what is most important to focus on is that these revenues are constitutionally protected and cannot be used for any other purpose. And for for us in local government trying to protect our communities and serve them well, it's important that the revenues that we receive for transportation infrastructure are used for exactly that. And that is what we have put in place here. And so these revenues cannot be used for any other purpose. They must be used to improve our roads, our bridges, in our highways, and there are thousands of local projects that are already underway that are doing that, improving road conditions, filling potholes, ensuring that bridges and overpasses are less congested and more stable. That's critically important in terms of ensuring that we have communities that folks can actually commute in. They can move around, goods can move, and the folks within those communities can get to where they need to go. And we're able to do so while spending the dollars in the most tax-efficient manner possible.
Yes.
That's exactly the right model. This is the model of accountability coupled with a prioritized revenue to protect our communities.
Is all of the money that's raised going for streets, bridges, highways, or are some of the funds being diverted to mass transit?
Well, the SB1 dollars are going directly to fund improvements in the transportation infrastructure in this state, and it's constitutionally protected revenues just for that purpose. It's focused on roads and bridges and highways. Certainly, local transit is an important part of the local transportation infrastructure for those that may not have access to a vehicle or who want to choose to instead of driving their vehicle to use public transportation, given the convenience and the benefits to the environment. So folks may choose to do that, certainly part of the overall transportation infrastructure. The primary focus of these dollars is really on roads and bridges and highways that have been eroded dramatically over the last several decades. And so we have a lot of ground to make up, and we're 17 months in. Progress has already been made, and there's much more that is coming.
Let's talk with Chris in Silver Lake. You're on Air Talk.
Hi, guys. I have a quick comment or question. Who's overseeing the way that these funds are being spent? I don't know if you guys have ever driven on the 5 freeway, but I've been driving it for 25 years, and every section of the 5 freeway has been under construction that entire time, from Burbank to Orange County, and it doesn't improve the flow of traffic at all.
Yeah, and do you mean that the construction itself takes forever, or that when it's done, there's no improvement?
There's no improvement when it's done, and it's still going on to this day. I don't know if you've driven the 5.
Oh, sure. Yeah, you can't avoid it, I don't think. Chris, Graham Knaus, you want to respond to that he's not seeing the improvement from what's already been invested in construction?
Well, I can't speak specifically to that project that you may be referring to, but I can underscore that our transportation infrastructure is the backbone of our overall economy. It's needed. It must be strengthened. There should be and is accountability and reporting relative to projects and how dollars are spent, how every penny is spent in communities across the state. This is a state, county, city partnership. as well it should be. And so all 58 counties and 482 cities in the state of California are moving forward on thousands and thousands of projects to increase the public safety in our communities and strengthen that transportation network.
Joaquin writes on the AirTalk page, the refiners have market power because California doesn't build new refineries. You can't take the profit from the refineries. They'll just raise their price and pass it on. Jamie Cord of Consumer Watchdog, you want to respond to Joaquin's post?
Well, you actually get two things. They do build refining capacity. There's expansions all the time of existing refineries. So they don't build new refineries, but they do expand capacity. And we make our gas all around the world. It just takes a little while to get here via ship. We don't have pipes bringing it in, but it can come from other places. We can actually do a windfall profits tax that doesn't get passed on, because if you tax excessive profit and apply it to the gas tax, if you apply it as a credit to every Californian, we'd see that the difference we pay literally with the rest of America, if you take it per year, we're talking about literally tens of billions of dollars. But five refiners do control 90% of Californians' refined gas supply. And they not only that, but they also have control over 80% of the retail gas stations, branded stations in Southern California. So the way the price is artificially high, and what the Governor's Energy Commission is looking into, is the role of this supply and retail price manipulation by all oil refiners. The thing that we put on their map was that the refiners who also control the gas stations charge their own gas stations, you know, their station owners, 20 to 30 cents more for the same gas that they sell 20 to 30 cents less at a Costco, at a World Oil, at an independent. And when they do that, they're artificially inflating, literally by 20 or 30 cents, the price of the same gasoline they give away cheaper to others so they can make more money. That type of manipulation and the way they withhold supply keeps the price artificially high. And when that happens, the profit reports don't lie. We see the profits jump for the refiners. So it is perfectly acceptable to say if 50 cents a gallon is the right profit for California historically, when the profits jump to 75 cents a gallon, we tax that extra 25 cents at 90%, and we get money back to the roads, and we reduce the consumer's costs. So it can be done without passing it on. But this market power issue that Joaquin raises is real. It is something that finally, I hope, because we have a governor who has refused oil industry money, he has not taken any for his run for governor, he's willing to actually look into this price manipulation. And we've chatted with him about this windfall profits tax, and we've chatted with people in the legislature about it, and the Democratic Party finally has agreed not to take oil money. So I think there is a changing of the tide. You're right, in the Brown era, it was oil refiners, you can't beat them, you can't do anything, let's just tax consumers. I think this is a different age in
South Carolina,
and while I'm a skeptic, I do see signs of trying to break up what is really too much market concentration, and we have all sorts of economists with us, so I think we're
okay. All right, I appreciate it. That's Jamie Cord, Consumer Watchdog President, Graham Knaus, Executive Director of the California State Association of Counties. And if you haven't had that shock of seeing the price at the pump or on the sign at the gas station, you will as you move around the next few days. Just about 6 cents a gallon increase as a result of the new California gasoline tax. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. It's been a huge NBA offseason for free agents, major stars changing teams, like Kevin Durant moving from the Golden State Warriors to the Brooklyn Nets. We'll talk about all the big changes and whether the Lakers or Clippers might pick up the top star of all left in free agency, Kawhi Leonard of the Toronto Raptors. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Back in just 1 minute. I got so excited when A. Martinez came into the studio for this next segment. I started asking questions for. We even came back from the break, and I realized that's selfish. I can't. The listeners have to get it fresh from A.'s mouth. That's not fair for me to do that. A. Martinez, host of Take Two, and for many years, the pre- and post-game host of Lakers broadcasts on ESPN LA to talk about NBA free agency, a particularly juicy year for free agents' stories. Also with us, Los Angeles Times national NBA writer Dan Wojcie. Dan, good to have you with us today. Appreciate it.
Thanks. I'm still waiting for my big contract.
Yeah, right. Very good. Well, let's talk first of all with where this sits historically. And Dan, you know, maybe fill us in. I can't remember a recent year in which so many big stars have changed teams.
No, this was a particularly active first 24 hours in free agency. At the Times, we did a list of our top 40 available free agents. And typically, you know, you'll get a pretty big handful of guys that re-sign and stuff, and it'll usually trickle out over a few days. You know, as of right now, I think there are only 7 of the top 40 still available, only 2 of the top 20. All 18 of the top 20 were agreed upon yesterday. It was almost as if somebody had been kind of holding the free agency hose tightly together, not letting anything come out, and then all of a sudden everything came out all at once. It was pretty crazy yesterday. I know a lot of people's heads were spinning around the league as deal after deal just kind of got agreed upon, and you could see the NBA kind of change right in front of your eyes.
So we'll talk about who's got the super teams in a moment. But, A, I wanted to ask you about, you know, the Lakers and Clippers, Kawhi Leonard, who arguably the most in demand of the free agents on the championship Toronto Raptors. What do you think the odds are he comes to Southern California?
Southern California, the odds are pretty good. If you'd have asked me this question 2 or 3 weeks ago, I would have said for sure it's the Clippers, because it just seemed like the Clippers have been waiting for this, have been really pushing all their chips in for this moment, and Toronto being that's his team, he won a championship there, he's the finals MVP, that would have been the only competition. But the second the Lakers got Anthony Davis, that all of a sudden opened up their possibilities, and then when they created all that extra salary room, now it could be that he does come to L.A., but just not where Clipper fans had hoped he would go, across the hall.
Can you imagine that front line LeBron, Davis and Leonard? I mean, that's stunning. Dan, can you imagine
all
that
would be
line?
Forgiven, Jeannie Buss. All is forgiven if that happens.
You didn't say those things about her.
It's the best three players to probably play together one time in league history. I don't know if that's hyperbole or not. It doesn't feel like it, right? Like, this is three, even if you're being generous, three top 10 players all at once. That didn't happen in Miami with their big three. It certainly didn't happen in Boston. It's hard to think of any Laker team that had three players that good at that and that kind of level of prime.
Wilt West and Baylor maybe would
Magic
would be
worthy Kareem, but Kareem was not in his prime
better.
Though.
Yeah. I think these three are better.
Yeah,
I mean, it's you've got LeBron James, who's, you know, I think going to be just fantastic this season after having time off, after having time to get healthy for the first time really in his career, having a real summer. You have Anthony Davis, who is very much just entering his prime, and you have Kawhi Leonard, who is square in the middle of it. I mean, you saw in the playoffs, that guy is you know, he might be the best player on the planet right now in the way that he can impact games on both sides of the court. And those three together, it's funny, you know, you look at kind of, and this will be the Lakers' challenge regardless of what happens. I mean, they've got 5 guys. If they sign Kawhi Leonard, they'll have 5 guys under roster. Well, 6, because they just agreed to a shooter named Trey Daniels. But, you know, they're going to have no money, really, throughout the rest of their roster. Even if they don't get him, then that's one less player. They still don't have a ton of money or guys that you'd want to give a ton of money to fill out the roster. It's a really interesting situation that the Lakers are in, one that they kind of have to be in, because if you get indication that you're in this, you kind of just got to wait it out.
Yeah, and so you're going to have just a bunch of guys coming off the bench. Kyle Kuzma will presumably
be the starting shooting
guard on the team. Yeah. Who plays the point?
I think it'll be a combination of Mantle and Martinez coming off the bench for the Lakers. I think KPCC will let us take on another job. Yeah, that will be the challenge. But the thing is, and Dan, you're right, the Lakers do have to wait. They've created all this money, and the questions were, do they fill out the roster with some solid veterans and use some of that money up, or wait for Kawhi Leonard to make that decision? And I think at this point, you do have to wait. Even if it means that you're going to be struggling to find some decent players to spend that money on, you have to wait, because if you get Kawhi Leonard, it is the game changer of all time, really, for the Lakers.
And Dan, what happens if the Clippers don't get Kawhi? Is there a plan B?
Yeah, I mean, I think their plan B is a little easier to execute. They can just essentially be who they were last year, right? They can be a team that still has sort of cap flexibility, that still has an interesting collection of young players and draft picks, that still can be sort of a destination. Now, this is a hit to kind of, you know, the culture that they've created. They've done such a good job, I think, in kind of turning around the perception around the league of what the Clippers are. A lot of credit goes to Steve Ballmer on that. A lot of credit, I think, goes to their front office. They had two guys this summer. This is almost unprecedented. They had two guys in their front office, their general manager, Michael Winger, and their assistant general manager, Trent Redden, who both turned down promotions to stay with the Clippers, you know, to kind of continue working there. And now they were compensated for that. And it was a good thing for them. But it's just, I think it speaks sort of to the overall culture. If they miss out on Kawhi Leonard, obviously their pathway to being championship contenders as soon as next year is shot. But they still have a lot of other really good things going for them. And I still think the same goes for the Lakers. It's not like the talent is totally bare. You know, they'll have LeBron James and Anthony Davis, who are two top seven, you know, two top 10 players too. So that's a good enough core to be competitive in what seems like is going to be a pretty wide open West. When you consider kind of the Warriors' injuries and how much talent and money was spent out east.
Why would Kawhi Leonard leave Toronto after winning an NBA championship and under the league rules, they can spend the most money to sign him?
This would be the first time he's getting to choose. He's never had that opportunity before, so he gets to chart his course the way he wants it. And if he wants to be paired up with LeBron James and Anthony Davis, two of the best players in the NBA, it would be the first time that he has made the decision on his own to say, this is where I want to be. And for a lot of players, for a lot of athletes, that's very, very important to have the autonomy to say, this is what I'm choosing, this is what I'm doing with the rest of my life, and leave it at that.
Even if he's going to have to share the spotlight with those guys.
But LeBron has said, though, he's willing to take a back seat. And Dan mentioned, Kawhi Leonard is one of the best two-way players in the NBA. That means he's one of the best offensive players and defensive players. LeBron doesn't play defense anymore, so it would be on Kawhi to take the lead in that role.
I think you bring up an interesting point, though, too, and I think I do think, and I wonder if this is something that I'm sure the Clippers will bring up when they talk to Kawhi Leonard. You know, part of the fun, I was around Toronto a lot this year in the playoffs, and you ask why you would want to come to Southern California. There were a couple 40 degree days.
Yeah, enough said.
Yeah, that would be good reasons why. but I think, you know, and he certainly seems like someone, this is home for him, not Los Angeles per se, but Southern California, and he has been here. He played college at San Diego State after growing up outside, you know, in Riverside. Like, this is someone who it seemingly, now this doesn't work for everybody. Some guys don't want to be around home. He seems like someone who does. And I think that's the geographical part of the pitch is something that Toronto knows they can't offer. But I want to touch on one thing you said, A, which is I do think, though, that being the offensive focal point in Toronto was something that Kawhi really appreciated. And if you talk to people up there, he wasn't the same kind of lockdown defender all for, you know, every time he stepped on the court. He did it in spurts. He did it in the playoffs terrifically, especially against Milwaukee. But this was a guy, though, that had the ball in his hands and took a lot of shots and was sort of their offensive star. And he's good enough to do it. You know, would he be super comfortable sharing the ball with two other great offensive players? And he might even still be today the best of those three at going to get a bucket. Would he want to not do that after doing it for an entire season? I don't know. It's a really interesting question.
Well, and if the Lakers don't have much of a bench, would Leonard's workload be able to be managed in the same way that it was effectively done in Toronto? That's another thing. He might have to play a lot of minutes without much coming off the bench.
Work either way. And I think on one hand, yeah, you know, their depth will be certainly, you know, their top to bottom depth is going to be a problem regardless of what happens. But also their top line depth is so good that you wonder if you could survive, you know, 20 games a season with only two of those guys. Mm. Three players could get rested.
So you just rotate them.
Somebody too.
Yeah. James writes on the page, I know how everyone's forgetting about Kyle Kuzma. He's going to have a breakout year. You could almost argue he had a breakout year last year. I was very happy that Kuzma was not one of the players who was shipped to New Orleans for Anthony Davis.
And the thing about if indeed Kawhi Leonard were to come to L.A., so Kyle Kuzma maybe won't get as many shots and maybe the emphasis won't be on him. But he can also fly under the radar and just wait for the ball to come to him, make those easy shots, have a great season, because all the pressure is going to be on three guys making millions of more money than he's making. So that actually would be a good thing, I think, for Kyle Kuzma.
Yeah, and maybe LeBron James is the point guard. Maybe that's...
I wouldn't mind if he had the ball in his hands most of the time.
Yeah, he'd just bring it up the court. We're talking with Dan Wojcicki, LA Times NBA national writer, and A. Martinez, host of Take Two, as we talk about the big NBA free agency. So, Dan, the Brooklyn Nets scored huge with their stars who were signed yesterday. Are they the immediate favorite in the East? Dan, you there? Oh, we apparently lost him. Are the Nets the favorite?
Well, no, and the reason for it is Kevin Durant's not going to play for them next year. He is injured. He's going to take
he's out the full year.
Yeah, he's out the entire season. So they only have Kyrie Irving as their lead superstar. And then when he eventually does come back, remember, Kevin Durant is on the wrong side of 30. I don't know necessarily if that was the wisest short-term move for the Nets. I think they're hoping that he gets it back and that he'll be fine the following season. But still, that side of 30, you're devoted a lot of money. If he's not quite the same, then are you getting the same return for the investment that you made in him? So I'm not quite putting the Nets on a pedestal quite yet.
All right. Dan, we just lost you there. So I was asking about... You know, are the Nets immediately the favorite after their signings, including Durant? What do you think?
I don't think so. I mean, I think obviously, you know, Kevin Durant is not going to probably play basketball next year. And if for some reason he was able to come back late in the playoffs, he would certainly only be a shell of kind of the guy he was right now. That's the Achilles recovery is sort of a multi-year process. But I do think they're in position. They have a really good roster around him. They're going to be a playoff team. You know, Kyrie Irving, DeAndre Jordan, Spencer Dinwiddie is a really good player from Los Angeles. They have some talent already there. It wasn't a situation where, like, the cupboard was completely bare. That it was a good team before. It'll be a good team this year. But favorite, I think, you know, I still look at the Milwaukee Bucks. I think they have the best player in the conference in Giannis Antetokounmpo. I think, obviously, if Kawhi Leonard returns to Toronto, they'll be in that mix. And I think there's some young, exciting teams that could kind of work their way into the playoffs picture sooner than later, too. That'll be really difficult. I think, and not to mention Philadelphia is still a team that has a lot of talent. So, you know, this is a multi-year thing for Brooklyn. Good on them yesterday. I think, you know, good on them in terms of, and we've seen the Clippers struggle with this, you know, being able to kind of overshadow and outwork the Knicks, like the team with more prestige and Madison Square Garden and all of those things, like that, you know, Brooklyn kind of, I think, took that narrative and killed it yesterday.
Is that because the Dolans, the owners of the Knicks, people just don't want to play for the Dolans?
I mean, that's a big part of it, I think. I think that it's also really hard to sign free agents. You know, and building through free agency is a tricky proposition. I think if you talk, I mean, the Lakers have been pretty successful at it, but they're one of the few teams that is sort of a destination year in, year out. You know, New York has tried this multiple times. I was kind of going through stuff. I mean, this is a place that, you know, reunited the Sopranos for an extra scene to try to impress LeBron James in free agency. And even that didn't work. They've been kind of down this road so many times and they've been so mediocre. Certainly ownership is a huge part of it. They don't have a winning culture right there. It is not considered a good organization when you talk to people around the league. People love playing in Madison Square Garden, but generally speaking, I think they mostly like doing it as visitors.
All right. And then, of course, the Warriors, they're going to have a very different year next year with Klay Thompson re-signing, but having to rehab and come back from his ACL injury, I believe it was.
But they got D'Angelo Russell, a former Laker, to basically just stand there and wait for the ball to come to him so he can hit three-pointers. So they should be okay. I don't see them falling off a cliff, but they're not going to be as dominant as they have been for 4 years.
Hey, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thanks,
we'll look
Larry.
Forward to hearing you this afternoon at 2 on Take 2. And Dan Wojcicki, LA Times national NBA writer. Dan, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
So much for having me.
Hey, appreciate it. You're listening to Wear Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, the past and future of the American automobile. How close are we to fully autonomous vehicles? And what other major changes affected the American car? And how did the industry adapt to that? Back after a live update from Julie Slater. Wonderful to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. I guess the theme of the day, looking back historically to better understand our future. We certainly did that looking at that huge supermarket strike and lockout of 16 years ago. And we conclude today's program by looking at the history of the American automotive industry and what that might tell us about the industry's ability to adapt to what seems to be the universal view that fully autonomous vehicles are the future. With us, Dan Albert, who is a historian from the University of Michigan, where he got his PhD. He writes about cars for N Plus One magazine, and his new book, Are We There Yet? The American Automobile, Past, Present, and Driverless. Dan, great to have you with us today.
Larry, excited to be with you.
Let's talk about some of these, you know, formative periods in my lifetime. I certainly remember the oil crisis and embargo and how that had an effect on the kinds of cars that were being designed out of Detroit and the rise of smaller Japanese, you know, vehicles to take that primary position. But you know, how often has the automotive industry gone through these sorts of cycles?
I think what you're talking about there is certainly something that's in my memory, the transition from sort of the great American boats that you and I probably grew up with to the smaller, more exciting to drive, particularly the Japanese coming in, but also go back a little further to the Volkswagen Beetle, which came in the 50s. And you see absolutely a transition in terms of the way we drove and in terms of the way we felt about cars. And then also it's worth noting that there was a real cultural tension, particularly in Detroit in the 1980s when those cars came in. Things like, you know, pay a dollar and smash a Toyota was a carnival event in Michigan. So that was certainly a transition within the industry. I don't know that it's as major a transition as really the beginning of the automobile. And now as we look towards the autonomous automobile, we're really talking about a profound, profound change.
So the beginning of the automobile, what we have at the start, a rich person's leisure time activity, and then Henry Ford changes everything.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, one of the things I like to point out is the automobile was invented many, many times over the course of history, going back into the 18th century. But it wasn't until the 1880s, 1890s that it becomes something that's desirable. And it's not really desirable as transportation initially because it's a huge machine and very, very expensive. So you have people like, you know, the Rothschilds, the Vanderbilts buying these what today would be $250,000 car and just going racing and zooming around town and having fun with them. So it wasn't really a transportation machine. And then, as you say, you get Henry Ford, you get Oldsmobile is another one, where particularly in the United States, this becomes very democratic and, in a sense, the car we know today, a car for everybody.
The industry has been accused, certainly in the 20th century, being caught, you know, flat-footed as societal changes or taste change, as economic pressures shift for what people are willing to pay or able to pay. How do you put this era where, you know, the future is uncertain about when
fully autonomous vehicles are coming and you know, how the industry is going to adapt. I mean, we're seeing, for example, a lag in the driving and sales of electric, all electric vehicles. I think, you know, a lot of people thought we'd be further along there. So how is the industry, in your view, poised to adapt to these changes?
I mean, I think it's a very good question. I think we should separate the domestic industry, you know, sort of the big three out of Detroit, and the global industry. If you look towards China, China's the number one market now. I believe it's about 30 million cars a year are sold there. Here it's about 17 million. So the Chinese auto companies are coming very fast. And they're coming to the United States, by the way, in a way that the Japanese didn't. In other words, they're not coming with small, cheap cars. They're coming with luxury automobiles. The other thing that's going on is it's become very difficult to make money selling sort of your bog standard sedan. In fact, most dealerships lose money on those things. Detroit makes its money selling pickup trucks, and the biggest sellers in the country are the 1, 2, and 3, are the Ford, the GM, and the Chrysler pickup trucks. So in a lot of ways, our domestic industry is shrinking to the point where Ford, for example, is a truck company. That's all they really want to sell, and they make very good money doing it. Whether those companies are poised to make the transition, I'm not an analyst of that. I can't say, but I will say that for all the excitement about kind of Silicon Valley startups, these companies in Detroit have so much capital and make so much cash that they can easily come in and just buy one. It's sort of small change for them. So how that plays out in terms of the industry, I honestly can't say. But then lastly, the need to keep up with the transition to electric and the transition to autonomy is very expensive, and these companies are investing heavily in it.
We're talking with car critic, historian, and author Dan Gilbert. Dan Albert, his new book, Are We There Yet? The American Automobile Past, Present, and Driverless. If you want to talk about the industry's evolution and how it's attempting to invest in the newest technologies, which will be dominant in the future, we're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. And like so many of us, I'm trying to square this industry that has consumers favoring larger vehicles, SUVs, pickup trucks, like you describe, and a future which is seen as inevitable as all electric vehicles, which almost out of necessity are going to have to be smaller, and autonomous vehicles, which aren't necessarily going to match up in usage with utility-oriented vehicles. So how do you square that, you know, how people are voting with their dollars with what the future is supposedly going to be?
Yeah, I very, very interesting questions. I think what we're seeing so far is, and as you say, the market, the public has not really gravitated toward these electric vehicles. California, in the United States, half of all electric vehicles are sold in California. And certainly people are motivated either because they happen to love the particular model or because they get incentives from the government. But it's not clear that on a comparable basis, these cars are, first of all, they're not profitable for companies to make, and secondly, they sell at a premium over comparable vehicles. I think the other thing worth noting is, you know, you think of Tesla, okay, so here's a cutting-edge electric car company. What they really have been selling is, you know, 0 to 60 acceleration of 4 seconds and a very large car with very good range and, you know, autopilot and things that really are in a lot of ways good old fashioned car things, right? So those, there's no sense in which that changes things enormously. In other words, changing from gasoline to electric changes things enormously.
We'll continue our conversation with Dan Albert, author of Are We There Yet? The American Automobile Past, Present, and Driverless. Also, take your calls at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Back in 1 minute. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Fresh Air with Terry Gross comes right up. But right now we're talking with a car critic and historian, Dan Albert, author of Are We There Yet? The American Automobile Past, Present, and Driverless. Greg in Beverly Hills, you're on Air Talk.
Hey there. I have a question. I'm looking at the possibility of buying a hydrogen car. It's a Hyundai, actually. But the infrastructure is so limited, basically to Los Angeles and San Francisco. And I'm kind of wondering if that, as they say, is going to be really built out, or is that going to fizzle out and everything's going to be pretty much more electric?
Dan?
I think, two things to point out. One is those hydrogen cars are, in fact, electric. You're putting hydrogen into a fuel cell, and that's going to power an electric motor. As far as where California is going to be in terms of the hydrogen car, it's one of these Betamax type questions. You can't predict too far, but they're certainly not putting the energy into that, and no pun intended, as they are into battery electrics. The one place you will find hydrogen cars, I think, in the nearer future is in Japan.
All right, Greg, thanks very much. And why is it that Japan has been moving forward on hydrogen?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are a lot of people skeptical of the idea of a battery electric car. Hydrogen allows you to refuel as quickly as you can refuel a gasoline car, and that remains one of the big problems with a battery electric car. So even if you have range, it takes you quite a while to refuel. And then I think the other is, you know, companies make bets on different technologies, and I think Toyota and Honda have gone down this road, Toyota particularly. They sort of have faith in that technology, the fuel cell technology, and they hope it'll move forward.
I want to talk about car culture. You write a lot about this, and we touched on it briefly. The wealthy person's racing and, you know, driving a car for pleasure. Then it becomes more integrated in a part of middle-class Americans' lives as it's mass-produced. And we give rise to a car enthusiast culture, which is not just a niche, but is pretty widespread, at least in this country. And people become knowledgeable about cars. They work on their own cars. It's a rite of passage for a young person to get his or her driver's license. And, cars become an extension of identity. That's changing very dramatically, where young people today don't necessarily rush to get their driver's license. They're not necessarily seeing cars as more than just a utility. And do you think that that's an inevitable progression, that American car culture is going to go away?
Well, at one level, I certainly hope not, because I like to work on my own cars, and I think there are a lot of people who will continue to enjoy really the fun of driving and not just in the kind of, you know, sports car, race car sense, but actually enjoy their own vehicle as, you know, their own. People still name their cars. People still look at them as a refuge. And I think the other thing, and I talk about this in the book, this idea of what I call incognito car guys. And obviously the term is gendered when we say guys, and the automobile is very much gendered as male. But I found, just in talking to people, that there are plenty of, middle-aged women, octogenarian men who still love their cars and have no interest in giving up driving in order to, sit in the back seat and be chauffeured around. But I do think, and we've already seen this, the kind of the newest car I work on is a 2007. I have a 2000 I work on. Beyond that, it just gets kind of, you know, you pull out one black box and you put it in the
body. I was going to say, it's not the same experience,
right.
Clearly. We're talking with Dan Albert, who's a car historian and critic, author of Are We There Yet? The American Automobile Past, Present, and Driverless. To what do you attribute this shift among younger Americans to where the feeling about cars is different? Do you think it's what you're just mentioning, that as they've become essentially computers on wheels and it's harder for people to work on them, that that's distanced people from their cars?
I certainly think so. And I think, too, the level of quality, you know, you don't worry. You can get a car and not worry about it. It's not as intensive an experience as it used to be. Even things like, you know, the rise of the car wash industry, you know, just take it in for a car, the Sunday wash, those kind of ablutions that you did with your car. People don't have that same intimacy. I will say, and I found this with my own daughter, you know, she turned 16 and she was sort of like, nah, you know, maybe I'll drive, maybe I'll get the license. And eventually, she learn to drive, and boy, does she love it. And I don't mean the sense of freedom. We all talk about that, and, you know, it's very important. You turn 16, you got your own set of wheels. But she actually, and we have an old minivan, she's perfectly happy driving that. She'll put on her music. We'll say, where were you? What have you been doing? Oh, I was driving. I was out driving, you know. And so even as that kind of intimacy with the vehicle and the machine itself fades away, I do think that as people get involved with it and actually drive, you know, as teenagers do get their licenses, they fall in love with the act of driving the same way Americans have for generations.
Boy, is that true with my son? He's 18, just turned 18, got his license first day he could after his 16th birthday, and he goes for pleasure drives. He'll come home and say, yeah, I was driving up Angeles Crest Highway, or, you know, just because for him, it's time for him to be alone and to think and to see different stuff. And I have to say, that's very much my experience of driving, starting when I was a teenager. For me, it's real psychological benefits. And I still love to drive, just back from a European trip where I drove nearly 2,000 miles in a week and a half. So, you know,
wow.
I love to drive.
Absolutely.
Through the Spanish countryside. Dan Albert, thanks so much. Appreciate your being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Always a good day when I get to talk cars.
Yeah, can't beat it. The American Automobile, Past, Present, and Driverless, the subtitle of Are We There Yet? From Dan Albert. Stay tuned. Fresh Air with Terry Gross is next. I'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 10 for our next Air Talk. A. Martinez joining me earlier today as we had a chance to talk about NBA free agency. And, of course, A's going to be with you with Take 2 coming up this afternoon at 2. Right here on 89.3. Have yourself a great afternoon.